Today we are going to be looking at Jesus choosing 12 men. And we are now at a point in his ministry where there are three responses to Jesus. First, there's faith in him as a person. There's faith in his signs. And there is the third response that is rejection of both him and his signs. The refusal to believe in who he is. Now, if we look at this screen, our timeline screen, we can see we're past the second Passover. We're into the second part of the Galilean ministry, essentially, moving up to the second Galilean tour. And we're about halfway through the time from the second Passover to the third Passover. We're still in the time of Jesus making public presentation of himself and his authority. We're also seeing continuing rising popularity as his miracles attract the attention of the multitudes. Now we see faith in him not only in Israel, because there are those who are in Judea and Jerusalem who do believe in him, but we see faith in him among Gentiles and even among the hated Samaritans. If you remember the journey when they went through Samaria and the whole town there of Sychar believed in him because of what he said. Now the enemies of Jesus since the second Passover are organizing alliances to oppose him, even to kill him. And as we saw last time, the Herodians allied themselves with the Pharisees, or I should say the Pharisees went to the Herodians, and remember the Herodians are allies of the Sadducees. So you now have pretty much the entire leadership opposing him and, as it says clearly, desiring to kill him. Now Jesus will now organize his followers so that they can face the opposition of powerful forces, these forces that are both political and religious. So this is why we come today to the choosing and commissioning of 12 disciples. And we find this in Luke chapter 6. And if we go to Luke chapter 6 and we look at verse 16, we begin to see Jesus calling 12 men. Now, some of these men have already been with him, but this is going to be an official commissioning, an official calling. And notice in 6:12, this is after an entire night of prayer. It says in verse 12, it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. This is an indication of Jesus and his humanity, his total humanity, as having dependence on his Father for his leading and guidance. Remember, he told the Pharisees in Jerusalem that I only do what my Father leads me to do. I only do his will. I have come to reveal him to you. This is an expression of this dependence he has on his Father. Now, in verse 13, it goes on to say that when day came, this would be an indication of at daybreak, he called his disciples to him. We're probably more than 12 at this point that were surrounding him, but he only chooses 12 of them, and he makes that point, and he chose 12 of them, whom he named as apostles, and this would be a change of status as his select 12, and he will then train them. They will become apostles, but he goes on to do the list, Simon, whom he also called Peter and Andrew, his brother, and James and John and Philip and Bartholomew. Now, there is basically a list of the first six apostles that he called. These men have already been following him. They followed him down to the first Passover and came back through Samaria with him. If you look on the handout that you have, Simon Peter is really the prominent one, but he's not the first one to meet Jesus. If you remember back in John chapter 2, it was Andrew and John, the writer of the Gospel of John. Andrew and John were the first two to meet Jesus, and Jesus really didn't call them to follow him. Remember, they were disciples of John the Baptist, and they were following Jesus. And Jesus turned around and said, "What do you seek?" And they said, "We want to seek where you are going or where you live." And he told them, "Well, go ahead, you follow me." It's at that point Andrew goes to Simon Peter, and Simon Peter, he becomes the prominent disciple, though he is not the first disciple. Andrew and John are actually the first. And Andrew's the only one named in John chapter 2. James, who is the brother of John, is the son of thunder. He becomes the first martyr. He's actually called later along with John as Jesus goes back and calls these four men, Andrew, Peter, James, and John, to follow him as they embark on the first Galilean tour, which we already have looked at. So John then becomes the last martyr. He dies, but Jesus sends him back. How does that happen? Well, he's dipped in boiling oil. And instead of being dead when they bring him out of the oil, he's still alive. Well, Jesus wanted him alive. Jesus sent him to Patmos, and as there Jesus appeared to him, and he actually wrote the book of Revelation. And from there on, he went to die what we would call a natural death. Philip is the one who brought a skeptic to Jesus. He's also listed in John chapter 2. He, remember, goes to Nathanael. Nathanael is from Cana. And he is the skeptic that first says, how can anything good come out of Galilee? Well, he then believes in Jesus. Jesus then calls Matthew the tax gatherer. This is before the first Galilean tour. And he is one who writes first gospel. He's actually chosen the same day that Jesus calls Peter, Andrew, James, and John. So there's these five that really accompany him then, that we know for sure accompany him on the first Galilean tour. Then we see Thomas listed. He's a believer who has doubts later on. We see that after the resurrection, he doubts the resurrection of Jesus. There's a man called James the Lesser. Don't know much about him, but he is not only the lesser. He is an apostle nonetheless. Simon the Zealot, he is one who is of that political group. And if you look at the article on the website called The Various Sects of Jesus' Day, you can read something about who the Zealots were. But the Zealots were fanatic followers, anti-Roman. They would carry knives under their cloaks. They would get close to a Roman soldier, put the knife under the ribs into the heart, immediately killing them. These men were fanatic terrorists. The fanatic becomes a follower of Jesus Christ. 11 is Judas Thaddeus. He is either a brother or a son of James. It's not clear which he is, and it's not clear which James is being referred to. Is it the James the Lesser, or is it the James the Son of Thunder? Last of all, there's Judas Iscariot, the son of perdition. He's the only Judean in the bunch. The rest are all from Galilee. Perdition, the son of destruction, as opposed to James and John, the two brothers who are called the Sons of Thunder. Their desire to call down vengeance from heaven against the Samaritans. The Son of Thunder could also be considered to be sons of anger. These are volatile men. Under the teaching and the example of Jesus, John becomes the beloved disciple. We don't think of him as being an angry person. John had the willingness to change under the ministry of Jesus Christ. So those are the 12 men. Those are the 12 men that are going to follow him. And in 6:17 through 49, Jesus begins the training of these 12 men. And 17 through 49 is really a rather long section, and it's called the Sermon on the Plain or the Sermon on the Level Place. We find that this is actually a shorter version of Matthew 5 through 7. And for an excellent full study of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, I would encourage you to see Bill Walker's series, the previous pastor of Grace Church here. Go to the website and look up the Sermon on the Mount series that he did. It's an excellent study, and he goes through the characteristics that Jesus expects to see in his followers. And not everyone agrees about the timing of these two sermons. Matthew 5 through 7, I think, is addressed to the multitudes that he gathered during the first Galilean tour before the 12 are chosen. This is before he goes back with his five disciples to the second Passover. Now, when they come back to Jerusalem, he goes up on the same hillside that overlooks Capernaum. It is here that he prays all night, as Luke says, and then very early in the morning, he chooses the 12 men, as we've seen. In verse 17, it says he comes down to a level place at the foot of the higher hill, that is the mount, that is where he would have given the first Sermon on the Mount, where the crowds again press in on him. It's so crowded, it probably demands a broader plain than the hillside of the mountain, because now there are many more followers since he has come through the first Galilean tour. He's been to the second Passover. Popularity has grown even more. So in the midst of this crowd, he begins to teach his disciples. Both of these passages begin with Beatitudes. The difference here with Luke is that Luke adds the woes in 6:20 through 26 that Matthew doesn't include in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, after the woes, Jesus says in 6:27, he says, "But I say to you," and he begins to describe how to be a blessing. The idea here is that you are blessed. You are blessed in spite of the circumstances you may be facing. But I say to you who hear and understand me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. And then from that section on, from 27 down through 45, he's describing how to be a blessing. If you have been blessed, then seek what is best for others, even your enemies. And so he says in verse 31, really, this is the golden rule, just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. Now, let's go on and consider what he's presenting in both the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, and here in Luke chapter 6. Just as John the Baptist demanded righteousness as a requirement for entrance into the kingdom, Jesus also said only the righteous can enter the Messiah's kingdom. For Gentiles, this was a totally novel concept because the idea of being righteous was actually foreign to them. They had no concept of the righteousness that God had declared for Abraham in Genesis 15:6, when it says that Abraham believed God and God reckoned it to him or declared him as righteous. In perfect standing, sins forgiven, all the blessings of God applied to his account. And the Jews then, who came to hear Jesus, did not need to be taught that righteousness was necessary for entrance into the kingdom, because the rabbis taught that. For them and the crowds, the question was, what kind of righteousness is necessary? Now, when they heard Jesus preach, they realized he spoke of two kinds of righteousness. First, there's the righteousness of tradition-based Judaism, the righteousness of meticulous attention to the feasts, the rituals of sacrifice, and most importantly, the traditions of the Pharisees. Secondly, a righteousness based on faith in himself as Jesus the Messiah. He spoke of righteousness not earned by works for God, but righteousness received as a gift from God. Pharisees said that the righteous had no sin that they need to confess. Now, in one sense, this is true, because when God declares us totally forgiven and righteous with righteous perfect standing before him, that really is true. There is no sin to be forgiven. But they had taken that to mean there is no sin in man that needs to be confessed as long as you are Jewish and are circumcised. Jesus said that the righteous freely confess the presence of sin and desire to change. This is the constant mental attitude of the believer in Jesus Christ. That repent, the kingdom of heaven is here, meant that though I am a sinner, I can be part of the kingdom because I can be forgiven and declared righteous. Now, Jesus says in Matthew 5:20 that the righteousness of the Pharisees is not enough. He says in Matthew 5:20, unless your righteousness goes beyond that or exceeds that of the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. In John 3:3, remember what Jesus said to Nicodemus. If a person is not born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. It is an impossibility unless one is born again. So the multitudes who came to Jesus were curious to see and to hear for themselves the things they had heard. Fascinated by his miracles, they held no conviction about who he really was. They had little interest in truth, and Jesus viewed many of them as outside the kingdom, but he is offering them a way in. So then that's why he tells them a parable in Luke 6, 46 through 49, which is also paralleled in Matthew chapter 7. Luke 6, 46 through 49. He says, and why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? Now here's the winnowing process. You call me Lord, you see me as rabbi, master, you see the miracles I do, but you do not do what I say. You do not take to heart what I tell you. He's going to press the curious sign seekers to a decision concerning his words and his person. And here's what he says. Everyone who comes to me, who hears my words and acts upon them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid a foundation upon the rock. And when the flood rose, the torrent burst against that house and could not shake it. But the one who has heard and has not acted accordingly is like a man who has built a house upon the ground without any foundation. And the torrent burst against it, and immediately it collapsed, and the ruin of that house was great. So here you have two houses that may look exactly the same. The work on the house may be identical. It could be, in fact, the one built on foundation that's not on rock could even be more beautiful than the one built on the rock. The point is that Jesus says, if you don't build on the rock, if you don't build your destiny and your life on me, that when judgment comes, you will be destroyed. Or to put it another way, to believe what he says means a change of destiny. You put yourself on the rock. When judgment comes, you will be safe. The Pharisees, their doctrines, their traditions, their rules, their practices will never save you. So how good does a person have to be to enter his kingdom? Well, let's go to Matthew chapter 5. We find the answer stated very clearly. We find that in the parallel, verse 48. Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, how can anyone be perfect in this life? Well, no one can be perfect in this life because we all bear with us Adam's sin. We're looking at the goal of perfection. We're allowing God to sanctify us, to train us. This is exactly what Jesus is going to have to do with his disciples. As they stand before him, they're not perfect, and he knows they're not perfect. But our standing before the Father is perfect because we're standing on the rock of Jesus Christ. In 6:8 of Matthew, you do not be like them. What they do is not good enough. Pray, therefore, in this way. He says, don't be like them, be like this. And he outlines the way they should pray, the way they should come before the Father. They should come before him and be repentant, forgiving, grateful. And it's also a looking forward to the kingdom coming that Jesus Christ will bring to this earth. That it is for his power and his glory, and it's going to last forever. This teaching was so different from anything that the Jews among them had ever heard. They were amazed at his teaching. They say that in 7:28 of Matthew, as he closes the sermon, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching. Verse 29 says, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. Now, the scribes had great respect for the scriptures. They're unlike the Sadducees in that way. They many times preached or taught in the synagogues. But they sought righteousness by works. Jesus' teaching was so different from the sermons of the rabbis because many times their sermons were narrow and they were simply quoting secondhand commentaries from rabbis who had written previously. They didn't preach in such a way that moved the heart or the will, where Jesus came and preached with an insight into the scriptures, was able to stir the conscience, was able to move the will. And so he preached in such a way that the people were amazed. He's telling them, you decide. It's life or death. Build on the rock or build on the sand. Only one will save you when judgment comes. Judgment comes for everyone. Death is the judgment for sin. Death was a result of the fall of Adam. Everyone faces death as a judgment. And without the foundation of Jesus Christ, you will not be safe when that judgment comes. Matthew 5-7 and Luke 6 focused on principles and truth from the scriptures. But Jesus is also going to teach his disciples from real-world events about who he is and what he can do. And that's where we go back to Luke chapter 7, and we're going to look at the centurion. It says in 7:1, when he had completed all his discourse in the hearing of the people, he went to Capernaum. And the centurion's slave, who was highly regarded by him, was sick and about to die. Now, this is the slave was highly regarded by the centurion. Verse 3, and when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of the slave. So he sends emissaries. They come to the Jewish leaders. And verse 4, when they had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated him, saying, he is worthy for you to grant this to him. For he loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue. Now Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, Lord, don't trouble yourself further, for I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But you just say the word, my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and another, come, and he comes, and I say to my slave, do this, and he does it. Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him, and turned and said to the multitude that was following him, I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. So he was healed before the servants even got back to the house. Now, when we look at this in a little more detail, that this Roman centurion is concerned about his slave. That is very unusual for anyone of means, and a Roman centurion certainly was a man of means in this culture. It's very unusual for them to care about whether a slave lived or died. Slaves were not people. Slaves were property. But this centurion asked the elders of the Jews to go ask Jesus if he would heal his servant. Now this is strange, because the elders of the synagogue did not believe in Jesus, but they were indebted to the centurion. Remember, he built their synagogue. Now, all this says a lot about the character of the centurion. This is more than a man of good character. He actually does believe in Jesus. To get an idea of this sense of means, he was able to give them the money to build their synagogue. This also shows him his regard for the Jewish religion and for the Jewish people, and you can see why they hold him in such high regard. So that's why the elders say, Jesus, he is worthy. But the centurion, through his emissaries, through his messengers, say, Jesus, I am not worthy. Now, what does he mean by that? What does he mean when he says that? He says, well, you as a Jew should not come to my Gentile house because I do not want you as a rabbi to defile yourself, because I'm not worthy to even come to you. So he sees his position before Jesus. He also understands the authority of Jesus, and this is key. This is why I say he does believe in Jesus, because he sees his authority as being like his, only greater than his, because he says, I am not worthy to even come to you. And he acknowledges that the one in authority needs only to issue the command to have something done. Now, when Jesus hears this, in Luke 7:9, he says he marvels at this in his humanity, in his human nature. Marveling. What does marvel mean? Marvel means you're seeing something that you can't explain by normal means. And what Jesus is saying, that how is it an officer in the Roman army has faith that I can't even see in my own people in Israel? Jesus heals this slave immediately, even having never seen him. The people who are watching Jesus, they only see Jesus' reaction to the faith that this centurion shows in him. Matthew does give a warning that Luke doesn't give. In Matthew 8, which is the parallel to this, in Matthew 8, 11, and 12, and I say to you that many shall come from east and west, now this would refer to Gentile people, Gentile nations, and recline, actually reclining at the table with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. This is fellowship. This is dining with them. These are the patriarchs of the Jewish nation. And they're going to come and recline in the kingdom of heaven. Now notice Jesus refers to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as if they are still alive, because in fact they are. They're alive with the Father in glory. But in verse 12 he says, but the sons of the kingdom shall be cast out into the outer darkness, not the kingdom of Jesus Christ, but the kingdom of Israel. The kingdom of Israel was formed after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs, had lived and died. And the kingdom was really formed under David and Solomon. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast into outer darkness, in that place where there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Not glory, not in the bosom of Abraham, not dining with Abraham. A foreshadowing of the unbelief and the rejection of Jesus by the nation. The miracle of the centurion is really a warning to the Jewish people that Jesus has not just come just for them to free them from Roman bondage, but to bring salvation to all men. Leaving that, let's go back to Luke and Luke chapter 7 and continue the narrative, because the narrative goes on to then report a miracle that occurs in Nain. And let's pick that up in verse 11 and read about that. It came about soon afterwards that he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large multitude. Now as he approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a sizable crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her and said to her, do not weep. And he came up and he touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And he said, young man, I say to you, arise. And the dead man sat up and he began to speak. And Jesus gave him back to his mother. And fear gripped them all. And they began glorifying God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people. And this report concerning him went out all over Judea and in all the surrounding district. Now here's a woman. Her husband is gone. Her son is dead. It's too late to ask for healing. She asks for nothing. She says nothing in this narrative. Jesus speaks, and it says the man who rose from the dead speaks. You have a procession coming from Capernaum. Crowds of people who have been healed from diseases, who have seen what Jesus is able to do. You can imagine the joyous shouting. They're following him. They're talking. They're excited. And this happy procession confronts the somber procession on its way to a burial site. You can imagine the crowds coming from Capernaum, seeing the funeral procession suddenly becoming silent. And they watch as Jesus approaches the coffin. What is he going to do? The first thing Jesus sees is the grief of the widow. He knows that as a widow who's lost her only son, she faces a life of poverty with no one to care for her. Jesus walks up to the coffin, probably an open pallet. He touches the dead man. And you have to think that under the law, this makes him, as a rabbi, this especially makes him ceremonially unclean. But for Jesus, this makes no difference. Jesus is not defiled by touching a leper, a dead man, or anyone else. That dead man comes back to life in 7:15, begins to speak. Jesus then is able to give the young man back to his mother. Now remember what Jesus told the Pharisees in Jerusalem at the Passover? An hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. An hour is coming, and now is. Well, this is the time. This is the first raising of a dead person by Jesus. He had clearly told the Pharisees that the time was now, that they were going to see things like this. And the people in Nain, their reaction was, a great prophet has risen among us. God has visited his people. They are excited. They are in awe and in fear, it says in verse 16. The word fear there means something that is so awesome, it is somewhat terrifying, because there's no way we can explain this. A dead man has come back to life, and they are going to talk about this. Can you imagine going to a funeral and there's a person in the casket and someone would say, Georgie, why don't you get up and walk out of here? And if that man got up and walked, you don't think that the people who saw that weren't going to talk about it? Here's an incredible, awe-inspiring, fear-inducing miracle that has hundreds of eyewitnesses. And this story is going to spread. This is a great prophet like Elijah, because this is a miracle that Elijah did. The great prophet, he raised that widow's son in Sidon, and they all knew that story. Remember when Jesus was in his own hometown in Nazareth, he tells them, Elijah went to the widow in Sidon. Weren't there not enough widows in Israel? Why did he have to go there? What was the reaction of the people of Nazareth? They were enraged by this because Jesus refused to work miracles in his own hometown. They would not accept him, therefore he would not work signs. Now Luke says that that news of Jesus raising a dead man spread to all of Judea. That is, it spread through the entire nation. And here's the problem for the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, and everybody else. The leaders of the nation cannot deny what Jesus does. There's too many eyewitnesses. What they have to do is to lie about what it means. So from now on, the 12 are going to be with him at all times. They have learned something very significant from these two miracles. Number one, Jesus has authority that is recognized by a centurion Gentile. Number two, Jesus has power over life and death, exactly what he had said told to the Pharisees in Jerusalem at the second Passover. What Jesus is going to do is train these men, train them by scripture and train them by example, so they will have his authority. If you look at Luke 6:40, we can ask the question, what does it mean to be fully trained? He says in 40, a pupil is not above his teacher. A pupil is always a follower. A student is always a follower of the teacher. But everyone, after he has been fully trained, will be like his teacher. So what he's telling them is, you disciples must become like me. Now, what he will do is he will commission them as apostles. And when he commissions them as apostles, his authority will become their authority. His mission becomes their mission. They will have authority over life and death. And they will carry on his work after his ascension to the uttermost parts of the earth. And they will be like him. How can we see that they are really like him? Well, he was poor. He was hungry. He was hated. He was outcast and insulted and put to death. They will all suffer the same fate. Why? He says, for my name's sake, for my message, for my mission. This is what he told them in the Beatitudes. Here's the Beatitudes that he outlines in Luke 6. Now, when Jesus spoke a blessing, he relates it to holiness. God's blessing is an expression of God's holiness. not only of His holiness, but the holiness that He's working out in your life. Now, this holiness can only come from His Father, Jesus says. That is why when you think about the entire Sermon on the Mount, it is incomplete as it stands. Because without Jesus on the cross on the Mount of Golgotha, the Sermon on the Mount of Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, is simply an ethical ideal. Though there are good ideals and there are useful ideals. In fact, the Beatitudes were used by Thomas Jefferson in the writing of our Constitution. So the ideals are important, but the ideals are not complete. You cannot separate the ideals that Jesus expresses in the Sermon on the Mount. You cannot separate it from the reality of the cross, because that's where the reality of the ideals come together. Jesus died poor, abandoned, and despised. The Apostle Paul said, I have been crucified with Christ. I view myself as having been there and been crucified with Him. Therefore, it is not I who live, but He who lives in me. He lived His life, a life of suffering, a life of torture, a life in prison. And He died poor and abandoned and despised, just like Jesus. When you tie the ideals of the Sermon on the Mount with the reality of the cross of Jesus Christ and how He died, the reality of the Sermon on the Mount is such a grave threat to all that our world holds dear, that the world will crucify anyone who holds these ideals as real truth, as something that can actually be lived. Jesus says, when you're persecuted, when you find yourself in these dire circumstances, consider yourself blessed. Leap for joy, for your reward in heaven is great. So blessed are you poor. Blessed are you who hunger now. Blessed are you who weep now. Blessed are you when men hate you, for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap. Your reward in heaven is great. Why? For in the same way their fathers used to treat the prophets. Now he goes to the woes. Woe to you who are rich, for you're receiving your comfort in full. Woe to you who are fed now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe when all men speak well of you, because for in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets. The false prophets were loved and they were elevated. The real prophets were hated and killed. We need a balance here because Jesus says, be glad in that day and leap, for your reward in heaven is great. We have to balance this with a line that's not in the text. I will balance this off by saying, you will not be glad in that day. When day of judgment comes, you will find out that you already had your reward. Remember what he told the Pharisees in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It says, these men stand on the streets praying. They want to make sure that you see how much they're tithing. They want to make sure you see how important they are. Jesus says, they have their reward. Their reward is now. They will not receive reward in heaven. You will not be glad in the day of judgment. Your reward is now. Now that brings us to an end of this study, Jesus choosing the 12 and the beginning of His training of them for them to take over His mission and His ministry. Next time we're going to look at John the Baptist, and we're going to see that John has doubts. Where he is doubting, are you the Messiah or not? There's two ways to look at this. Is this John's faith failing? That are you really the Messiah? Or is it simply John's patience is failing? Is this the kingdom or not? Is the kingdom here? And if it is, why am I in prison? Because he would assume that if Jesus was in fact instituting the kingdom, John would certainly be a part of it and hold a place in it, a place that wouldn't look like prison. So with that, let's pray. Dear Father, we do thank you.